everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
Now I'd like to introduce you to Meaningful Beauty, the famed skincare brand created by iconic supermodel Cindy Crawford. It's her secret to absolutely gorgeous skin. Meaningful Beauty makes powerful and effective skincare simple, and it's loved by millions of women. It's formulated for all ages and all skin tones and types, and it's designed to work as a complete skincare system, leaving your skin feeling soft, smooth, and nourished. I recommend starting with Cindy's full regimen, which contains all five of her best-selling products, including the amazing youth-activating melon serum. This next-generation serum has the power of melon leaf stem cell technology. It's melon leaf stem cells encapsulated for freshness and released onto the skin to support a visible reduction in the appearance of wrinkles. With thousands of glowing five-star reviews, why not give it a try? Subscribe today and you can get the amazing Meaningful Beauty system for just $49.95. That includes our introductory five-piece system, free gifts, free shipping, and a 60-day money-back guarantee. All that available at MeaningfulBeauty.com.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles, ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Oh, hi. Hello there. This is Let's Talk About Myths, Baby. And I'm your host, Liv, here with another conversation episode. Today, I spoke with Jillian Glass, who's doing her PhD at UBC, i.e. the university just across the Salish Sea from where I am, and that alone was a true thrill. But also, Jillian came to me as a guest through the magnificent Michaela. That name behind so many things on this podcast these days. So huge thanks to Jillian for coming on the show and also to Michaela for making it happen. Jillian is here talking about epiphanies, a concept I'd never really thought about when it comes to Greek mythology, but one I will now never ever stop thinking about every time I talk about these stories, because it turns out there are a hell of a lot of epiphanies in Greek myth. Jillian is also cross-trained in religious studies too, which was fascinating in itself, as I am not one who ever thinks about religion, but it also means that Jillian speaks about a lot of epiphanies in the Torah, in addition to Greek myth, looking at them individually, but also what makes them similar and different. And honestly, I don't want to say too much more, because if I give away what an epiphany is, then it's going to spoil the whole beginning of the episode. But safe to say, we had so much fun talking about this. And again, I will forever think about epiphanies when thinking about Greek myth. Particularly, I will think about what the gods might have smelled like. Yeah, just wait. It'll make sense very soon. And just a note, too, that we had this brief audio issue in the form of construction. You basically won't notice, except in one word that I couldn't cut out. But I don't know. I guess I still feel like I should explain it. It is my way. I also left in an appearance by Lupin the Cat, because I just know you'll all appreciate that. And it's been a while since he's been involved with the show. So sit back and enjoy all of this talk about divinities and the varied forms of epiphanic experiences. Conversations. Can you smell the god in the air? Epiphanies in Antiquity with Jillian Glass. right. So honestly, I'm so interested in what you study, but I also like don't know anything about epiphanies. So figure maybe we'll start with like, what is that in relation to, I know your religion as well as classics, I think, right? But mm-hmm. like, what are those, particularly in a like ancient Mediterranean, less religion-y way?
Yeah, what is an epiphany is a great question. In modern vernacular, we use it as the aha moment, right? Mm-hmm. I was working on a project and I got stuck and then poof, I had an epiphany, the light, you know, the cartoon light bulb moment of, you know, something hits you. And it's so interesting to me because most people don't think of that as a religious concept, even though it's in that moment, it's not unlike divine inspiration, right? The muses appearing to Hesiod on Mount Halicarnassus. But the word epiphany comes from a Greek root, epiphainein, which means to appear. And a really, really simple definition of epiphany would be the manifestation of the divine to an audience. That manifestation can take a whole whack ton of different modes. You can see a god or a deity or a demon, because that's the other thing. An epiphany doesn't have to be a god. It could be any other kind of divine or otherworldly creature. And as you know, the ancients believed in all kinds of otherworldly mm-hmm. beings. A ghost of an ancestor can be an epiphany, right? So yeah, seeing is definitely the primary mode. The verb epiphainein involves vision for the most mm-hmm. part, but you can hear a god, you can smell a god, you can be touched by a god.
Smell a god. I love that.
Well, we sort of laugh, but one of my favorite epiphanies is from the Homeric hymn to Demeter, and it's in the house of the king and queen when Demeter has disguised herself as an old woman, and she is found dipping the baby in the fireplace at mm-hmm. night, and the queen freaks out, right? What are you doing with my son?
Moments. Yeah.
And then Demeter, of course, sees this as a betrayal of her trust and her sort of hospitality gift. You've given me this hospitality. This is my hospitality gift to you. I'm making your son divine. And so this is the moment when she manifests to the household. And we get this amazing description of her growing in size and her age drops off of her. She's now this beautiful young woman and she fills the house with two really important things. The first is light and the other is a wonderful smell. And so it is because we have this flashing light and this odor that we know we're seeing a goddess and not just some, you know, mundane magic trick. And so you can smell the divine in the ancient world in a way that I think for us is probably, particularly us who live in the West, who have, you know, middle-class upbringings or middle-class resources right now, who are used to showering on a regular basis. I mean, we walk through the street on a hot summer day and if someone's trash is out, we go, oh, that smell, right? It's shocking for us. Mm-hmm. But bathing cultures, access to clean water, you know, clean environment, the ancient world was smelly. And not even the ancient world, like 100 years ago, yeah. New York was literally so full of horse poo that they had to have a crisis management system in place, right? So it is only in relatively recent history that we have the hygiene practices that we do. And we have that old proverb that cleanliness is close to godliness. And it really, in my mind, comes from this world where people didn't bathe as often, they lived with animals, they didn't have the same disposal systems or sewage systems that we have. And so someone who only smells good, that's an elite marker. And someone who smells yeah. divine, well, that's just a whole other level. So yeah, you can smell the divine.
That's so interesting. I love just learning things like that, where it's something where it's like, yeah, it makes so much sense. And yet it's like, we don't think about it because it's just so foreign.
No, because it's so easy to hop in the shower. Yeah, like I've already had a shower today. I might have another one.
Yeah, and we like recognize that. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's quite all right. I get really easily off track, really on this subject. So yeah, when it comes to what is an epiphany is the manifestation of the divine to an audience. That audience is often human, but it doesn't have to be. So in the Homeric hymn to Aphrodite, when Aphrodite is approaching Anchises, but she hasn't got there yet, we have all the animals who are fawning and dancing mm-hmm. around her. She's manifesting the natural world fawns all over her. And we see, if memory recalls, there are also wild beasts like lions or leopards or wolves. I can't exactly remember.
I feel like it might be all of them.
It might be all of them, right? So there are these normally ferocious beasts who just fawn at her feet. And it's because she's a goddess. They are recognizing her divinity. So you can manifest to the divine world. The other way in which manifestations of the divine can happen is in natural phenomena. So when we think of Zeus's lightning bolt, or in the book of Job, God speaks to Job out of the thundercloud. So that thundercloud, because we don't see God in that moment, and it's not clear whether we hear a divine but human-like voice in the thundercloud, or if Job is hearing thunder rolling and he just understands what it means. But so the rolling thunder or the flash of lightning, that is also a divine manifestation, or a huge and unnatural wave hitting the side of a ship could be understood as a manifestation of Poseidon. So as much as we can see the divine, we can hear them, we can smell them, we can touch them, sometimes the shape the divine takes is not anthropomorphic. So it could be a natural phenomenon, or it could be zoological. So in the Iliad, we have several goddesses, Athena, Hera, who turn into birds at different points. And the bird shape is understood as the divine form of the god or the goddess. Yeah, so we have Aphrodite who manifests to the natural world, and so we have the animals who fawn over her. We can have manifestations of gods in some sort of zoomorphic shape. We can think, for example, of Dionysus, who appears as a lion on the bow of the ship. Dionysus also appears as vines snaking over the ship to the sailors, and so he gets some really fun, what would you call that, like floramorphic. I'm mixing languages here, so it doesn't quite work. So gods can take any and all shapes. They can be experienced in any all kinds of ways. The most common is certainly the visual aspect. That's often what is described. Humans are a fairly ocular-centric species, and so that's what we look for. But there are lots of examples of epiphanies that don't come with vision. So we can think of when it is Pheidippides. So when Pheidippides runs from Marathon to Athens and Pan shouts at him in the mountains, you know, erect an altar to me sort of thing. He doesn't receive Pan. He doesn't, you know, he has no visual confirmation of this, but he hears the divine voice of the god of the wilderness, and he's going to follow what the god tells him. And of course, then the Athenians do triumph at Marathon. And so there's an auditory experience of epiphany, and epiphany functions as a crisis management tool or as a plot shifting device, depending on whether you want sort of a truly literary analysis or if you want something that is verging on historical in that. And in both cases, something that seems inevitable is overturned by divine intervention. And so it's not unlike the theatrical Deus ex machina, God out of the machine, which often accompanies an epiphany. So we can think of Medea, who, you know, it looks looking really bad for her, and then Helios's chariot pops up and she's saved, right? So that is simultaneously a deus ex machina. We have a machine, a chariot. We also have the theater machine that the ancient theater hands were manipulating. But the deus is a really important part of the ex machina. So we have the god intervening. And so what was previously an inevitable plot line, Medea is going to be assaulted by an angry mob and or the, you know, Jason or the king or somebody, she is saved by divine intervention. Same thing. Things are going poorly at Marathon. We have Pan say, hey, you worship me and I'll solve this for you. They worship him. Pan causes panic among the enemy and the Athenians triumph at Athens or at Marathon. So epiphany functions in a lot of stories in that crisis management kind of way, or it takes a story and elevates it to something completely unexpected. Anchises isn't expecting to have an erotic encounter with a goddess. And so his epiphany completely alters the course of his whole life, but it's not a crisis moment per se. It's just a way of taking something that is otherwise mundane, having a nap in the afternoon, as delightful as that is, and turning it into something extra, something more. And so the epiphany operates in that way as a story shifting device.
This is so amazing, mostly just because, like, you're telling me all of these stories other than Marathon, which I'm never good at remembering, but that like that I know so well, but have never thought about that structure, like of just the appearance of a god. Whereas like just because I handle the myths all the time, it's like, well, gods appear all the time.
It's something we take for granted.
Yeah.
And when we teach introductory courses and we say, well, what's a myth? And how is a myth different from a legend? And how is that different from a fairy tale? How is that different from whatever? Mm-hmm. We often say, well, there are gods in myths. And that's one of the defining differences. And it's true. I'm not disputing that. But it, when we focus on different things, it operates or it shifts the way we read or we hear those stories. And so I gave a talk many, many years ago at this point, where I actually started with a reference to Disney's Cinderella, because when Cinderella is in the courtyard crying because her dress has been torn, her stepmother has said, you can't go to the ball, and she's been, you know, meaner than usual, we see her crying. And at this point, we're going to get a bunch of cues. The music starts to shift. It gets a little lighter, a little airier, a little bubblier, a little sweeter. And then we have the bubbles that start to drift onto the screen, and the light changes. The scene goes from being entirely dark to having these pinpricks of bubble light that show up on the screen. And even though we don't know what's going to happen, although, of course, Cinderella is so well known, we all know what's going to happen. But even though we don't know what's going to happen, we know that something really special is on its way, because Cinderella, by all rights, by all human intervention, is not going to go to the ball. It's just not going to happen. Mm-hmm. But then the music changes, the light changes, and then out of nowhere, somebody appears, and the fairy godmother appears in this flash of light. And okay, in Disney Cinderella, she's a bit of a goof. You know, she's short, she's round, she can't find her wand, she's a bit silly. But we understand right away that she is an otherworldly creature. She is something else, and she has the ability to alter what is otherwise an inevitability. Cinderella is not going to go to the ball. And then the magic, we can see it happening, because Cinderella's dress doesn't just change. It changes in this cascade of stars and dust and sparks, you know, fairy dust kind of thing. And so we can see that it's not just any old dress. It is a magic dress. It comes with divine help, or at least otherworldly fairy help. So even in stories where we don't have gods, we don't have heroes, in the, you know, the archetype hero, cult hero kind of way, we still have this imagery that tells us that things have changed. And this imagery is so powerful, it's so pervasive, that it really transcends genres and modes of storytelling. So another cinematic example, which is very recent, is the She-Ra and the Princesses of Power series on Netflix. She-Ra, well, when Adora, did you watch the series?
No.
Oh, I love this series. It's amazing. It's also a total nerd fest for anyone who does Bible studies or biblical studies. Ooh. Or theology. Yeah, particularly that final season. That's a whole other conference talk I gave. The use of the apocalypse of John and She-Ra. It's a great show.
Heard of it? This is great to know.
Oh, it's a remake of the 1980s She-Ra, Princess of Power. But it's the queer-tastic, neuroatypical, all-inclusive TV show we all needed.
Oh, my God.
Even if you didn't know you needed it, you need it.
Yeah.
It's amazing. So She-Ra is the sort of the heroic model that the character Adora turns into. And so Adora takes her sword and she says the magic words, and then very Sailor Moon spins around, is transformed, and there's always the same theme music, and there's flashing lights and changing colors, and she gets taller and her hair gets blonde. So it's Greek myth everywhere, right? You know, heroes are tall, they're beautiful, they're blonde haired. It's very, anyone who knows their Greek myth is going, yeah, this makes sense. She looks like a hero now. But the thing that's fascinating to me in those stories or in the modern telling is that the epiphany is no longer external to the hero. Because if we think of Dionysus appearing to somebody, or Athena appearing to somebody, or even the fairy godmother appearing to Cinderella, the divine is outside of the hero. But in stories like Sailor Moon or in She-Ra or even in Captain Marvel, when the epiphany happens, it is happening in, by, and through the main character, which is a really interesting development in storytelling. But the through line in all of those is that the same visual markers are happening. The person is beautiful. They're tall. We have flashing lights. We have lightning. We have, you know, street feats of great strength that happen. And so the basic signs of epiphany are there, and they are thousands of years old. And so it's really a key part of storytelling that we are using and we're reusing and we're transforming as we go. But it's still a way of marking to the audience, pay attention, something that you thought was impossible is about to become impossible. And I'm going to tell you this by having some lightning flash across the stage.
Yeah. That's absolutely fascinating. I do this every single time and I've got to stop. But all my, I just say that's fascinating every time everyone's finished speaking, because it's always true, but it also
always true. Yeah.
Just need to find another word.
You need to have a thesaurus page behind your microphone so you can just pick your adjective.
I've now just taken to making a joke out of it every time because I physically can't change. Too. So I might as well just point it out.
Just lean into it.
Exactly. But it's, yeah, again, like all these things I think about all the time in relation to mythology, but without recognizing the distinct qualities and like what makes them unique in this way. It's so, yeah, it's so interesting. Now I'm so curious about how these kinds of things work with, I mean, I'm sure they're all still epiphanies. I can already picture it, but like, I just keep thinking of like the sheer volume of times that Zeus will appear to somebody in the form of animals and other people, what have you, all these different ways in which, you know, he typically against, you know, other people's will, gets to, you know, do whatever he wants. And now thinking about those in this kind of way is sort of adding a whole other level of weird, I guess.
Yeah. Well, epiphanies are a really interesting rhetorical device for authority. Because when the god appears, they often come with a message or a demand. And this is true across ancient cultures. As you said earlier, I'm cross-trained in classics and religious studies. And so an interesting comparison is to the prophets and the prophetic call narratives of the Hebrew tradition. And so if we look at either Abraham or Moses, for example, they are both called by God to do something that is, frankly, unappealing. Abraham is called and he's told, you know, pack up, leave the family and the culture and the geography that you grew up in and just go. Walk until I tell you you've arrived. That's, you know, for ancient peoples who, I don't remember exactly what the studies say, but until not too long ago, most people didn't go further than 50 kilometers away from the place they grew up, right? Yeah. So having a god appear to you and say, okay, pack your bags and just walk until I tell you to stop, that is weird. That is not something you want to do. But he gets up and does it. God calls to Moses out of a burning bush and says, go to Pharaoh and say, release these thousands of slaves. That is also just an impossible thing to do. Or another, let's take an example from women. God appears and says, he says it to Abraham, but Sarah overhears, you know, you're going to have a, Sarah's going to have a baby. And Sarah is eavesdropping at the tent flap. It's a great scene. And she laughs to herself and she says, now that I am old, will I take pleasure in my husband, right? Because she's in the story, she's 98 or 99. And she's going like, there's no way. Yeah. The characters in the first book of the Torah in Genesis are very, very long lived. And she's going like, you're kidding me, right? Like, there's even a line, the line right before it says, now Sarah was old and the way of women was no longer with her. That's a literal translation. Yeah, they're saying like, she doesn't menstruate. She's not getting pregnant. She's past. That age. And so she's laughing about this, right? And so all of those things are impossible. But God says, do it. And even when characters demur or they object, like, I'm old, I'm not gonna have a baby. Moses says, I can't go and talk to Pharaoh about this. God says, no, but I'm with you, so it'll happen. And indeed, Sarah gets pregnant. Moses frees the Israelites, the Hebrews. But so what that does is it creates authority for either the action or the character involved. Isaac isn't just a baby. He's a miracle baby born in his parents' extreme old age. So this justifies his inheritance over his half-brother Ishmael, who was born to another woman earlier in the story. It also justifies the inheritance of the covenant between God and Israel going to him and not to the other brother, or going from Abraham to him. Moses freeing the Hebrews through God's assistance justifies the relationship between Israel and God. Or to switch back to our classics examples, if we go back to the Homeric hymn to Demeter, when Demeter appears to Metaneira and says, you know, I would have made your son immortal, but you screwed this up. And so to, you know, keep me from getting really angry, you're going to found a cult to me. And here's what you're going to do. Well, okay, this is going to be the cult of Eleusis. So what comes first? This justifying epiphanic story wherein Demeter herself ordered the now mythic king and queen to found a cult. Not even the king. We can throw him right out, baby and bathwater. Like the queen. This is a women's cult. It's not in antiquity a women's cult, but it's a cult about women that is mythically founded by a woman and her daughters. So what comes first, the story or the cult? And so the epiphany is a rhetorical strategy that justifies all kinds of things. And so, you know, the examples I've given, you know, Isaac and Moses are, or Sarah, Isaac and Moses are all sort of in the very epic history. They're not necessarily in the tangible history, but in the Homeric Hymn to Demeter, we have real historical political context. And then, of course, that gets even more complicated when we look at the socio-political relationship between Eleusis and Athens. Eleusis, which used to be its own independent polis, but by the classical period is a part of Athens. And this festival is really their one moment where they get to say, you know, we have independence, we have power, and we are not entirely beholden unto you, Athens, so fuck off. Basically, we have the grain goddess, so you know. So Epiphany, while it is something that we just sort of take for granted in these stories of gods and heroes, often acts beyond the story itself. It's not just, and I would even go so far as to say it's never just about good storytelling, although epiphanies are really good storytelling. It's always something more. It always takes the story one step beyond. And the power of epiphany as a rhetorical literary device is that it has authority both in the story world for the characters and in the real world for the audience listening to that story, because it either reinforces values, morals, institutions that exist, or it justifies a change in values, morals, and institutions. And so to come back to the Hebrew Bible, the prophets, and most of the books of the prophets aren't popular with kings because they usually show up and say, you're not doing it right. And I have come, God has sent me to tell you, you're not doing it right. You can imagine a monarch wouldn't be too happy with that message. No. But if we genuinely believe that the prophet had a vision from God and God sent the prophet, well, now we actually have to listen to them, right? We see similar figures like Tiresias in Greek mythology. Mm-hmm. Everyone loves to just shit all over Tiresias, right? And Oedipus, and Oedipus Tyrannus, right? Nobody wants to deal with Tiresias, and Oedipus is going to accuse Creon of being in cahoots with Tiresias and say, you know, you're plotting against me. And they're both going, no, there's no plot here, buddy. We're just trying to tell you how it is, which you claim to want to know.
Oh, I love that part of the story.
I love teaching that part of the story. The students never know what to do with it. They're like, but he wanted to know. I mean, it's like, the truth is hard.
There are just so many things with Oedipus. God.
It's such a good text.
Yeah. You cannot take what he's learning. Just can't. We'll never accept it. Everything is in front of you. You just have to actually listen, and then everything would be so much better. I love it so much.
It's kind of a pre-therapy therapy, right? Like he thinks he wants to know, but he's on the journey, the really hard journey of self-knowledge. And we all, hopefully, those of us who, you know, spend enough time trying to actually engage with ourselves on this kind of emotional level, we've all had those moments where, you know, learning to face the music about ourselves is really, really difficult. And we do all, you know, maybe not on a daily basis, but we do all have those moments in life where we choose to either accept truth or you know, bury our head and keep going, even if the mm-hmm. ways in which we've been doing things don't work for us and we need change. And Oedipus is just, to my mind, he's the poster child for that, right?
Yeah.
So Freud was right. It's a great text for therapy. What Freud did with it was wrong, but
yeah. Well, yeah, and like, okay, maybe Oedipus had it particularly tough in trying to face something about himself. Maybe it's not super easy to accept the fact that you married your mother and actually you love her, and what do you do with that?
Fine. Yeah, you know, again, it's a great example of it's not your fault, but it is your responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
Intergenerational trauma, not your fault, but it is your responsibility.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Also a little bit his fault, just with the killing of his dad, you know.
Yeah, I don't know. Little, did he know?
Tiny piece. No, he didn't know, but he still killed the guy.
I was going to say, yeah. So his fault for murder, that's entirely exactly. on him. He didn't need yeah. to lose his temper.
Precisely. From beyond that, I agree. Yeah, you yeah. know, a lot of just bad stuff happening.
So much bad stuff. My grade 12 English teacher summarized Shakespearean tragedy by saying, everybody dies, including the family cat. And I laughed at the time when she said it, but then I started reading Greek tragedy and I went, oh my God, mm-hmm. Mrs. Mulder was right. In a tragedy, everybody dies, and probably the family cat.
Yep. Yeah. And where there's not death, there's just some unimaginable horror to be faced with.
And frankly, death might be better in those stories. Exactly. You're like, oh, yeah. On the other hand,
I think Oedipus would have preferred it.
Yeah. Plucking out your eyes, maybe not the right choice. Like, Jocasta might have had the right idea.
Exactly. Yeah.
Gallows humor, anyone?
So when it comes to, say, like Zeus being a swan and yeah. Leda,
yeah,
like I think that sounds like a great example of what would be an epiphany, especially because it leads to people like Helen and mm-hmm. and the Dioscuri and all of that. So it does. Or I assume they are just like also epiphanies when even Zeus just shows up to assault people in the form of animals.
Those are epiphanies. Those would be called, or I would call those zoomorphic epiphanies.
Right.
To sound very scholarly with my 10-cent words. You could call them animal epiphanies. If you,
yeah. But zoomorphic is a great word.
It is. I know someone who is working on a book about the animal imagery used to describe Jesus Christ in various gospels. And when I hang out with him, I ask him how his zoomorphic Jesus work is going. I keep waiting for him to change the title of his book. I've handed it to him on a plate, yeah. Zoomorphic Jesus.
Right? Yeah.
Also like, yeah. It sounds very, very much like those, Animorphs, those books from.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, oh yeah. I am the right age for that.
Yeah, I know. Right. Like who doesn't want to read, you know, Jesus the Animorph.
I got to picture the cover. Like, oh my God.
With the 16 yep. pictures lined up on top of each
transformation.
Other. Yeah, yep. Jesus becomes an eagle. So you have like a man with a beard in one corner and an eagle in the bottom and the shifting in the middle. It's just, yeah, the imagery just perfect. Works that's, itself. Yeah,
absolutely. That would be a popular history book.
It would be. I appreciate this is not necessarily the right medium for this next comment, but I work mostly in literature. And I would be remiss to say that epiphany is not just a oral or written storytelling device. Earlier, I was talking about cinema. And we, of course, have moving pictures. But the ancient world had so much imagery everywhere. And so the first thing I thought of when you mentioned Leda and the swan was some of the iconography that represents that. And we have iconography that represents epiphanies. And it's the interplay between image or object in epiphany is really fascinating. There's a stele image of Demeter and Persephone appearing to, I've forgotten his name, one of the sons of Metanira at Eleusis, and he's the one to whom they teach about agriculture. You can put it in the show notes if you really people really want to know. But
is he the one who becomes the more important one at Eleusis, or just a random name?
No, the one who becomes more important at Eleusis.
Yeah. Now I'd like to introduce you to Meaningful Beauty, the famed skincare brand created by iconic supermodel Cindy Crawford. It's her secret to absolutely gorgeous skin. Meaningful Beauty makes powerful and effective skincare simple, and it's loved by millions of women. It's formulated for all ages and all skin tones and types, and it's designed to work as a complete skincare system, leaving your skin feeling soft, smooth, and nourished. I recommend starting with Cindy's full regimen, which contains all five of her best-selling products, including the amazing Youth Activating Melon Serum. This next generation serum has the power of melon leaf stem cell technology. It's melon leaf stem cells encapsulated for freshness and released onto the skin to support a visible reduction in the appearance of wrinkles. With thousands of glowing five-star reviews, why not give it a try? Subscribe today and you can get the amazing Meaningful Beauty System for just $49.95. That includes our introductory five-piece system, free gifts, free shipping, and a 60-day money-back guarantee. All that available at meaningfulbeauty.com.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Are you tired of your scented cleaning products smelling and cleaning like meh? Then it's time for an upgrade with the power of Clorox Scentiva. With an uplifting scent that smells like coconut, Clorox Scentiva gives you powerful clean like Clorox, but a feeling like being transported to a tropical island retreat. Imagine putting your phone on Do Not Disturb, tuning out all the constant. Just the feeling of warm sand in between your toes and a fruity drink in your hand. The ones with the little umbrella. Refresh your home to feel like an all-inclusive vacation by getting Clorox Scentiva. Also available in grapefruit and lavender scents at a nearby retail store.
So in that image, the two goddesses who are both sort of ageless, they could be anywhere from like 20 to 35, both of them, right? You can't really tell the difference between Demeter and Kore. But they're both head and shoulders and then more taller than this full-grown man. And so this is not a moment wherein he's a child. He is an adult. But the goddesses, because they are goddesses, are larger than he. And they're beautiful. And he's got this look of shock and awe on his face, because shock and awe is an appropriate response to meeting the divine. Or we have images of the Dioscuroi on their chariots, or on their horses, I should say, flying over a banquet table. And one of the characters in the image is holding up a goblet of wine, sort of as a libation or a pre-libation moment to depict honoring the arrival of the Dioscuroi. So we have images from the ancient world that show epiphanies. And we also know from the ancient world that objects or statues were used in epiphanic rituals. So even though we don't know exactly what was going on at Eleusis, because it's a mystery cult, yeah, it's kind of the definition of mystery, we know that at some point there would have been ritual use of objects. And we know that, for example, a statue was paraded from Athens to Eleusis. So that is an epiphany. It's not like in the stories where Demeter literally shows up. It's her statue. We also know that the statues of the Dioscuroi were used during war to inspire the troops. So those are called pars pro toto epiphanies, which means basically a part of the whole. And so an object, it's kind of like synecdoche, right? When you say, and the crown decided, like, you don't actually mean literally the crown decided, you mean the monarch has decided. So this is the object version of a synecdoche. And so the statue of the god stands in for the god, and it causes an epiphanic experience for an audience that can be an army, it can be an individual, it can be a crowd of worshipers. And so we know that the interplay between god and human, or religious efficient and religious participant, is facilitated through epiphanic experience that the object, the cultic object, whether it's actually a statue of the god or it's a garment that the god was said to have worn, or Cinderella's shoe is a pars pro toto epiphany in some ways, right? This shiny glass shoe that we know alludes to this unidentifiable being, and we're going to walk around the kingdom showing the shoe to everybody, you know, and they're all going to react to it. So epiphany is a great storytelling device, but it's not just in text and in oral tradition. We also have images of it, and we know that ancient audiences engaged with these objects in a epiphanic experience or a mode of epiphanic visualization.
That's wonderful. Yeah. Like a real life epiphanies through that. Yeah.
Well, and we could think of, I don't spend a lot of time doing modern religion, but of course when someone studies modes of religious communication, they tend to think about these things generally, but I'm struck, for example, during Mass, when the wafer and the wine are held up, and depending on the flavor of Christianity, the actual moment is worded a little bit differently, but when they're held up to the audience of community members, and there is some statement of, this is the body of Christ and this is the wine, the blood of Christ, that's a pars pro toto epiphany. They are visualizing their God through this object. Or in Jewish worship, at the end of reading Torah, when the Torah is held up, there's a moment where members wrap the corners of their prayer shawl, their tallis, around their pinky finger, and they point at the Torah and they say, this is the Torah written by the hand of Moses. Well, the synagogue I go to, our Torah is from the 19, I can't remember, but it's from the 20th century.
Right.
Not written literally by the hand of Moses, but the words were written by the hands of Moses, and Moses was the intermediary by which God's word came to the Israelites, and then that word has been transmitted over generation and generation. And so the relationship to God is being mediated through the reading of this sacred text in community. And so by pointing at it and by communally looking at this object, it acts as a pars pro toto epiphany, a manifestation of the divine among us as this object represents. And every religious spiritual community that has a God, so not necessarily some sort of, humanism or that sort of, spiritual community, but any community that has a God of some kind or a divine being has these pars pro toto experiences of some kind. So it's not a mode of divine encounter that has dissipated over the centuries. Mm-hmm. It's just altered, or the objects used has shifted.
Yeah. I never think about religion at all, honestly, but totally, but even fair. Yeah. But hearing it that way, that's so interesting, because I didn't know the thing about the Torah. That's quite interesting. But I did know the, whole body and blood of Christ thing, and so yeah, just imagining that in that way is fascinating. My cat is here to just distract everything. Hey, kitty. Do you want to be here or not? He says,
what's Kitty's name?
I'm a menace. Lupin.
Oh, hi, Lupin. Good cat.
He's a very good boy until he, thank you. He's my old man cat, but he likes to purr really close to the microphone. He's very loud. I'm a professional,
Now I'd like to introduce you to Meaningful Beauty, the famed skincare brand created by iconic supermodel Cindy Crawford. It's her secret to absolutely gorgeous skin. Meaningful Beauty makes powerful and effective skincare simple, and it's loved by millions of women. It's formulated for all ages and all skin tones and types, and it's designed to work as a complete skincare system, leaving your skin feeling soft, smooth, and nourished. I recommend starting with Cindy's full regimen, which contains all five of her best-selling products, including the amazing youth-activating Melon Serum. This next generation serum has the power of melon leaf stem cell technology. It's melon leaf stem cells encapsulated for freshness and released onto the skin to support a visible reduction in the appearance of wrinkles. With thousands of glowing 5-star reviews, why not give it a try? Subscribe today and you can get the amazing Meaningful Beauty System for just $49.95. That includes our introductory 5-piece system, free gifts, free shipping, and a 60-day money-back guarantee. All of that available at meaningfulbeauty.com.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles, ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Are you tired of your scented cleaning products smelling and cleaning like meh? Then it's time for an upgrade with the power of Clorox Scentiva. With an uplifting scent that smells like coconut, Clorox Scentiva gives you powerful clean like Clorox, but a feeling like being transported to a tropical island retreat. Imagine putting your phone on Do Not Disturb, tuning out all the constant, just the feeling of warm sand in between your toes and a fruity drink in your hand. The ones with the little umbrella. Refresh your home to feel like an all-inclusive vacation by getting Clorox Scentiva. Also available in grapefruit and lavender scents at a nearby retail store.
Well, that's, yeah, the Eleusis thing is so interesting. And it's funny you mentioned the Dioscuri too, like being used during military things. Military, specifically Spartan military, is a thing I've basically never thought of. But I just yesterday recorded the beginning of what I'm going to create into a quite an epic series on Sparta. And heard about that. And then they brought Menelaus, like a statue of Menelaus to war as well, and like kind of deified him in that way. Mm-hmm. And that's just extra fascinating. Yeah. And of course, Eleusis is something that I always want to know more about. So just this idea of how they kind of handled that divine experience and that just the all of those aspects of how they connected with the gods in that kind of quite literal way is so meaningful.
Yeah, and there's a really interesting juxtaposition between epiphany in storytelling mode, I guess I would say sort of textual storytelling mode, and epiphany in ritual mode. I'll say real world, but that doesn't quite fit. Mm-hmm. Because in storytelling mode, epiphany is very often spontaneous and unexpected. Mm-hmm. So when we think of Demeter appearing to Metanira, Metanira doesn't know that the old woman is a goddess. She doesn't know what's happening. And that's, you know, it is her fear around what's happening that sparks the goddess's anger, and the goddess appears. And then, of course, that changes Metanira's fear, but it's still fear. So now she's afraid of the goddess as opposed to her son dying, but it's still fear. And so, but that scene is completely unpredictable. Metanira doesn't know in going into that room that she's about to encounter a goddess. Whereas a participant in the illusion mysteries, or one of the religious officiants in that situation, knows that they are there to create divine encounter. And so there is a ritual preparation for it. And then we wind up in the ideas around liminality and transformation, because again, it's unclear to us exactly what was going on at Eleusis, but we know that they marched from Eleusis. There were a couple of moments where they bathed. There's torchlit walking at night. The ritual objects are carried from Athens to Eleusis. They get to Eleusis. We think there was probably some kind of ritual retelling of the Persephone Demeter story, whether it's the reading of the Homeric hymn as we have it, or it's some sort of performance somewhere in the middle, a puppet show, who knows, right? Mm-hmm. Cutout dolls, have no idea,
could
right? Could be anything. It could be a, you know, a sound and light, like a hand puppet with lights on a sheet, right? Yeah. I don't know. I wasn't there. God. That'd be so cool.
Could you imagine though? That would be so amazing.
And that would play, would play with the ideas of light and dark that are going on in that whole story. So I'm going to, forever forward now, I'm going to imagine that it's like, you know, a shadow puppet show.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Yeah. And okay. So anyway, But that's a very deliberately created epiphanic experience. And so there's a really interesting combination and or juxtaposition of epiphany in storytelling mode, which is spontaneous, unpredictable. And because it is spontaneous and unpredictable, it says something about the relationship of the audience to the god who appears. They are chosen, they are special, they are unique in some way, or they're chosen to do something unique compared to the ritual enactment, wherein all those who participate are now the special, the chosen, the unique, which is not to, you know, diminish their specialness. It actually amplifies it, right? Because I am having an epiphany of Demeter, just as Metanira did here at this location, all of those, you know, years ago in that time out of time and that space out of space. And so now I too am participating in this tradition. And so in this way, the epiphany and the locality of epiphany operates to connect time and space both vertically and horizontally across community and across generations. And so it is not just in this moment. It's sort of the cosmic now, which is both now and yesterday and tomorrow simultaneously, as the worshiper stands seeing Demeter epiphanine at Eleusis, which connects them throughout all of these things. So it's a it's a very powerful, I'll say moment, because it's not even about literature at that point. It's a very powerful moment.
Well, and it just makes me think too of like on the literature side, of course, it's not literature as we think about it now too, which I think adds so much to that epiphany aspect, where like, nobody was writing these stories to just like tell a fun narrative or to entertain people. Like, you know, it connects with like the inherent nature of Greek myth and like the why, which of course we don't have like a super defined answer to the why, but like it wasn't to tell a story like we think about them now. It wasn't like a TV show. I want to make this entertainment for other people. It's like understanding the world around you and understanding your deities and like, who knows kind of the original like thought processes behind them, but it adds so much kind of meaning to these epiphanies, even in literature, because they are still so like inherently tied to culture and to like cultural expression and just like a general development of the ancient Greek people in these different ways. And then tying that in with the ritual is sort of just adds like a whole other fascinating layer.
Yeah. I think of these stories and the gods that manifest in them in a sort of comparable way as to, I want to say it's Hippocrates, but I can't remember. Maybe it was Galen, or it might've even been later. Whatever doctor said, tell me what you eat and I'll tell you who you are. I think of epiphanies and the stories around them in that way. And it's more like, tell me what stories you tell or what stories you keep, and I will tell you who you are. And then that you is not an individual you, it's a plural you. Tell me what stories your community holds sacred, and I will tell you who you are. Or, you know, I shouldn't presume, but, you know, those the stories about gods and the connection that we have with them are fundamentally the stories about us and who we are, where we come from, and where we hope to go, and how we hope to get there. Because there's often an inherent understanding that relying on one individual to shape history is kind of a risky choice. You could get a wrong individual. But the gods, we have this idea that they won't mislead us. And so if it happens in an epiphany, well, then it's meant to happen, right?
Yeah. I so rarely get the chance to think about all of these things in real world ways, like the ritual and just like the general everyday life. It's something I want to get more into, but obviously I'm like more so about the telling of the stories themselves and constantly now emphasizing how the intention behind the stories and the narrative like point, really, or lack thereof rather. But just even thinking about it in these real world contexts is so interesting to me. And then imagining kind of like what other kind of rituals and epiphanies were then taking place in other spaces and in other, I mean, like Eleusis is such a great example because it is such an important,
yeah, for sure,
like mystery cult, just such an important like entire thing in the ancient world. But my current obsession is the mystery cult on Samothrace, which we know even less about. which becomes just like then a spiral of like, all I want is to know more and everything. And now I'm already kind of imagining what little I know and like what kind of epiphanies could have been taking place in there. But we don't even know fully what gods they worship there. And it's a whole other millions of questions. But thinking about this
so
ritual
many questions. Is just, for sure. Well, the other layer of epiphany that we haven't even got to, there are so many layers, is that they don't have to happen while you're awake.
Ooh, okay.
They happen in dream as well. And so it was a known fact in antiquity that dreams could be interpreted. And I appreciate there are lots of people who still today, you know, think about their dreams and what they're trying to say, because even if they are, you know, just the manifestation of your subconscious in a distorted sense, that still means that there are things that you are working through and, you know, are coming out in different ways and it's creating different stuff for you. But in the ancient world, it was understood that dreams came from the divine. And now there are, by the time we get writing about this, and I'm thinking, for example, of Lucian of Samosata, so the second century CE, there's an understanding that there are two, I know he's so fun. There are two gates out of which dreams come. And there's a gate of horn and a gate of gold, I think. Mm-hmm. But there's two gates. And out of one gate comes true dreams. And out of the other gate comes false dreams, or just sort of like fantasy dreams sort of thing. But you don't have to be awake to have an epiphany. You can be sleeping. And so we have these stories of gods appearing to humans in dream shape. And that is an epiphany. And so God in Torah appears to a king to say, basically, stop persecuting Abraham. He's my prophet. Well, that's an epiphany, because God has appeared in a dream and spoken authoritatively. Don't, you know, stop doing this. Don't. Or dream and dream epiphany gets incorporated into medical practices in the cult to Asclepius. So someone who was ill and who went to Asclepius, god of medicine, would go to the temple and would sleep in the temple, and the next day would tell their dream to one of Asclepius's priests, and the priest would interpret the dream, and that was understood to be how the cure for the disease would be understood. Oh, Asclepius in the dream manifested as four intertwined snakes, which means you need to go and do XYZ. I made that one up, but we do actually have recorded examples of people who went to Asclepius's temple, had a dream vision, the priest interpreted it, and the interpretation is how the person got their cure for their illness. So that's a really interesting and on some level extreme example of the ways in which medicine and science, magic and religion all overlap in antiquity, because the person is going to get a diagnosis and a prescription, but they get it through an epiphany while they were sleeping in the temple of Asclepius. And so that's not an epiphany in even a pars pro toto sense of, I went to the temple, I saw the statue of the god, and the statue, you know, told me to do X, Y, Z. It's, no, I slept in the temple overnight and the god showed up and spoke to me.
Yeah, Asclepius must be one where there's a lot, right? Because so much of that cult and the, like, the healing practices were kind of tied to worship, but also, I just feel like even just you saying that is bringing back memories that, of course, I can't fully trace, but
no,
to hearing these kind of things about Asclepius, yeah, of just like the way that he manifested in terms of healing people is so, yeah, it must be kind of full of those kind of dreamlike states and epiphanies.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Yeah. There's so many different ways that these things exist.
So many different ways. Yeah.
Oh, I love it. Yeah. Yeah, is there, do you have like a favorite?
Do I have a favorite epiphany?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really hard. I feel dissertation honor bound to say that my favorite epiphany is in Joseph and Asenath, which is a, as far as we can tell, first century BC Jewish story written in Greek, probably in Egypt, but we can't be too sure. That is an expansion on literally two sentences in the Hebrew Bible, and it becomes this whole 29 chapter story about how Asenath, the daughter of an Egyptian priest, sees Joseph, falls madly in love with him, and gives up her idolatrous polytheistic ways to join him in his worship of the true God, the highest God, the living God, as he is referred to in that story. And it's an epiphany packed document narrative. And it's actually through that story that I came to Epiphany Studies, because I was I've been working on it for 10 years at this point. And at one point I went, there's an awful lot of epiphany happening here. What is this? Why? But I really like the epiphanies in that story, because the fluidity of the storytelling mode of epiphany becomes really clear in Joseph and Asenath. And it's actually the entire subject of my dissertation project, to look at where and how epiphany overlaps with different kinds of storytelling devices. And so epiphany doesn't have to be just epiphany. Just not that it's, you know, seeing a god is ever just anything.
Pretty cool anyway.
It's still pretty cool. But epiphany overlaps with lots of other kinds of storytelling modes. And so one of them is military and military crisis. And how does it overlap with that in a way that is similar or different to other storytelling modes? Epiphany also overlaps with prophecy and acting as the intermediary between God and human, or gods and humans. And then the other one, the third one that I look at, which is always a fun one, is epiphany and romance, or epiphany and erotic storytelling. And the in English, what we call love at first sight, in French is called a coup de foudre, which means a lightning strike. And so the French actually maintains the epiphanic nature of the love-struck experience of, you know, we can think in cartoons of the, you know, the stars and the, you know, the eyes that get all glittery and shiny, and seeing the lover as divine. And that also is, you know, we see it in the Homeric hymn to Aphrodite. And so it's not, you know, unique. None of these things is unique in Joseph and Asenath, but Joseph and Asenath is doing really interesting things with them. So it's not necessarily a specific epiphanic moment that is my favorite, but because of the intensity and the volume of epiphany in Joseph and Asenath, and its overlap with a whole bunch of other stuff, because even though it's a Jewish text, it's written so late that it's incorporating both Jewish and Greek traditions. So the epiphany in this document speaks of a fluidity of literary genre, as well as a fluidity of religious storytelling approaches in the ancient world. And I think that it is what those epiphanies represent that make it my favorite.
That, yeah. Yeah. I mean, volume alone sounds interesting.
There's like seven epiphanies in 29 chapters. Like, it's great.
That's amazing. Yeah. Just volume of epiphanies. And now you preempted me. Like, once you started talking, I had a thought, and then you already went to it, so it's perfect. But Oracle, like the Oracle, so yeah, how does that fall into it? Is that just like a ton of epiphanies? Like, what's, yeah.
Well, it's going to depend on what Oracle you go talk to, right?
Right. Delphi.
Let's pick Delphi. Yeah.
She's talking to the god.
She's talking to Apollo. You know,
yeah.
She's connected.
Yeah.
So being the divine intermediary is an interesting position to be in, because it brings out the question of, is relaying a divine message always an epiphany? And if I, you know, leave Delphi for just a moment and we look instead to the Hebrew tradition, the prophetic call, the moment wherein God says, you're my chosen, whether it's Moses or Jonah or Jeremiah or, you know, take your pick, Ezekiel, Isaiah, there's lots. That moment of, you're my prophet, I choose you, is going to be an epiphany. And it is the epiphanic aspect which lends authority to the prophet. The prophet can't just show up and say, I am a prophet, listen to me. There has to be some sort of, I'm a prophet because God chose me, therefore listen to me, because you're not actually listening to me, Jeremiah, to me, Isaiah, to me, Ezekiel. I'm a nobody, but I am the channel for the divine. And that status as channel, as intermediary, is created by epiphany. In order to continue to be a prophet, one is sustaining a relationship with the divine. And whether or not that relationship involves further epiphanies depends. In these extended narrative prose, for example, Moses, God and Moses chit-chat all the time. Like, they have a very involved relationship. So there's extended epiphanic experience for Moses. Mm. Whether that's the same for all prophets? Not always. Or at least in the texts that we have, that's not always the case, because the books of the prophets are a very different kind of writing than what we find in Exodus. So to come back to Delphi, for example, the oracle at Delphi is undoubtedly a channel for the divine. They are an intermediary. They speak on behalf of the god. Whether or not that's an epiphany, that becomes a little bit different, because as the mouthpiece of the god, are you experiencing the god at this moment? We could argue that, you know, by smelling those fumes and, you know, being in that space, they in some way themselves almost become a pars pro toto sort of, you know, stand-in for the god, in the same way that a statue becomes a stand-in for the god, but you can have an epiphany with a statue. So as I talk this through, because you're asking a question I've never actually really thought about, the short answer is probably yes. That is going to be epiphany upon epiphany upon epiphany. But it takes us into the really nitty gritty of an epiphany. And in that moment, who's having the epiphany? Is it the oracle who's having the epiphany? Or is it the audience of the oracle? Or is it both of them? And it's just a different kind of epiphany. So
The priests that are interpreting her too. Like, there's so many intermediaries involved in the oracle. Because it's like, she didn't talk to anyone directly. She heard from the god, and then the priest interpreted her, and then they told the person who was asking the question. It's like, there's so many go-betweens. That's,
Great question.
I mean, I love all this stuff so much.
It's so fun. It's so interesting.
Yeah. And just like, even how much is in the Homeric hymns, where I'm like, man, I've read those like a dozen times, and I'm just like, new things.
I'm constantly. Always excited to reteach them, because it means I get to reread them. And every time I read them, I go, oh man, I never saw that before.
They're some of my favorites.
Or it's the difference too.
The American Hymn to Hermes.
Yeah. Oh, the American Hymn to Hermes is fun.
All the time. Yeah. It's the greatest thing ever.
It's a great one. And it's the difference too between reading them and hearing them. One of the things I've started doing with my students when we read any of the theater pieces is I make them put their books and their laptops and everything they take notes on away, and we read it out loud, and we take one book and we pass it between us, and they just have to sit there and listen. And then we have a conversation around, well, how is this experience different? Because in theory, you read this before coming to class. That doesn't always happen.
Yeah, you know, but, 50-50 in my time.
Exactly. In theory, you read this before coming to class, and so you've had an experience of it as a text on a page. Which isn't to say you memorized it, but you experienced it as a text on a page. And now you've sat for 40 minutes and listened to it as phonemes that come in and out of your ears, and you experience it differently. So how was this different for you? Every single student says something to the effect of, this was totally different. I heard different things. There were different emphases. I noticed different aspects of the story, or because, you know, this was read by a female voice and this was read by a male voice, I heard different things. Or, you know, like there is a big difference between the oral experience of a story and the written read experience of a story as well. And so that's something else I haven't done yet with the Homeric hymns, but I'd be really interested to do with, take your pick, right? Any of them, and just read it or hear it and experience the epiphanic moment in that way, rather than in the text. Because when we have it as a text in front of us, and especially when we're working on them for research, we go back and we read the passage over and over and over and over again. Whereas when you're just sitting and hearing it, it's a fleeting instance, and then it's gone. And in some ways that mirrors the epiphanic experience. It's this intense moment, and then it's gone. Mm-hmm. And did it really happen? Do I have proof that it really happened? Am I changed in some sort of corporeal way? Am I changed on a spiritual level? What's going on here? It's over. And so there's also an interplay going on in all of that. You can't just sit and contemplate it, which is then different again to the iconography. I can sit and contemplate a statue, or I can sit and contemplate Demeter and Kore appearing to the son of Metanira, and I can sit there and stare at it, you know, for a longer period of time. And that's different from
even a ritual experience where there's a statue, but at some point the ritual's over and it's mm-hmm. taken away. So there's all this, and this is something I haven't spent a ton of time thinking about, but it would be really interesting to dive into the audience's temporal experience of Epiphany mm-hmm. and the in the moment versus after the fact, and how does the Epiphany transcend the moment in which it happens to outlive the disappearing spark.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, now I'm just thinking about, so I have read the Homeric hymns aloud into a microphone for my listeners, and I'm always the one reading it aloud versus listening, and I'm just kind of thinking about it in that way, because there are some of my favorite things to read out loud. So I've both told the stories in my sort of retelling kind of way, and then I've also just read aloud, unfortunately, like old public domain translations, so they're just kind of stuffy, but they're still good. And so like basically I'm just kind of like, oh, I'm kind of glad I've given my listeners this experience of they both get to experience kind of like an analytical retelling of it with commentary and the like, and then a straight up just like reading of it where I just read the whole hymn, and it is like a, even for me as the reader, it's a totally different experience. And it also means I get to read multiple translations, because I'll do the retelling with the modern translation and then, you know, and read an older one aloud and all these different things. And I think, I mean, that's, I think, why podcasts generally are, you know, a thing people like, audiobooks and the same.
Yeah,
but just thinking about it in respect to the Homeric hymn specifically, because that is obviously like how they were meant to be told. It is like, you're supposed to listen. You're supposed to just like sit back and listen and take all of this in. And so I think it does, I mean, certainly for the Epiphanies, but also just as the hymns themselves, like mm-hmm. it does add so much to just be like listening and
poetry
in.
Generally, right? This is not I appreciate that there are some poems, I forget the name of them, but the ones that, you know, look like a shape. So it's a poem, but a vase.
Yeah.
It's like a vase.
Very visual.
Yeah. Those ones have a visual component, but poetry is often about the oral experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I absolutely adored listening to Claire Danes read Emily Wilson's translation of the Odyssey. I have it on my phone.
Oh, I need to listen to that. Oh my God.
It is a masterful performance. It's just breathtaking. And when in Greek mythology courses, the encounter with Circe is on the agenda, I tell my students, you know, read it and then come to class, and I play it off my phone and we listen to it, because it's just, it's a totally different experience to hear it. And Claire Danes does just an amazing job.
Oh yeah. That's wonderful. Yeah. I've only been able to read the Homer aloud in prose, because the best translation that's old enough for me to legally read it is Samuel Butler's.
Yep.
Which works well in audio, but like, oh my God, I love reading stuff aloud too. And I'm like, the idea of reading Emily Wilson's aloud, I just
and the poetic translation is so good. It's so well done.
Oh exactly. That translation alone is just so brilliant.
Oh my God. I think I remember reading somewhere she's working on the Iliad now.
Yeah. And she has been for a while, so I think it's probably, hopefully, pretty far along. I've got my fingers crossed it's not going to be that long.
I do too, and also I will wait. Like, I don't want that to be a rushed project. I want that to be, you know, detail oriented and
exactly. just as good as the Odyssey.
Yeah.
I think a lot about new translations. There's a new translation of Metamorphoses that's coming out next month.
Who by?
Stephanie McCarter.
Okay.
Yeah, she's been tweeting about it for a while, and I think it's for Penguin too, so it should be like a pretty big one. And just like the idea of like a modern woman translating.
I was gonna say,
Ovid,
I'm all over these
generally.
Women translations. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, and she seems cool. We follow each other on Twitter, and I'm like, okay, I'm really excited for this. You seem like the right person to translate mm-hmm. Metamorphoses. And I actually watched her speak about it with a couple people who have done like retellings based on Metamorphoses, and just like interesting hearing it from that aspect and just that work in general, because there's so many, like, I think Ovid really handled women quite well in a way that is just kind of like waiting for a good translation.
Yeah, it's really interesting because Ovid, you know, he's basically telling rape stories. That's the entire mm-hmm. book, but he does it in a way that's not entirely gross. There really is an empathy that is there in the Latin that shockingly, doesn't make it into a lot of translations. I wonder why.
I know. Yeah. Like, yeah, it is just exactly empathy. Like, he tells the stories with the right amount of empathy and horror. Like, he recognizes the horror that's inherent in a way that, like, yeah, you read, say, Hesiod, and it's like, I have no idea whether you have any thoughts about any of this at all. Like, I just, you know, yeah.
It's the neutral author or the neutral narrator.
No, no. Yeah. Had so many fights with people about Hesiod because they're like, he didn't say it was assault. So clearly it's consensual. I'm like, yeah, that's how it works. Yeah, for sure. For sure. For sure. Yeah. In any case, tangents on translation, but, yeah, I mean, but is there anything, any other, you know, epiphanies or details or whatever that you want to talk about? And if you have time.
I mean, I could talk about this stuff all day, every day. It's why I do what I do.
Yeah, I know. I'm the same. I could talk about myth and translation for the rest of my life and I would be perfectly happy.
I know, right?
This has been absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much for speaking with me and talking about Epiphany and talking about religion and all these different things. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Liv, for providing a platform for me to nerd out for a bit.
Oh, it's my absolute favorite thing. Just truly. That's why the first thing I say is like, if you just want to rant, please do. Because people are always apologizing for a rant. I'm like, no, I literally just want people to rant.
This is why I host the podcast. So yeah, you can rant.
Yeah. So you can rant about the thing that you find so interesting that you've studied for 10 years and you want other people to know about, and all my listeners love it, which is my other favorite thing, is like, just they want to hear all this stuff from people who study like these tiny intricacies, and that alone is so cool. Do you have anything that you want to share with listeners, promote or tell them where to follow you or read more or anything you want to share like that?
Sure. I'm on a social media break until I'm done the dissertation manuscript. So I'm not active at the moment. But if people want to follow me on Twitter, I'm at Jilly, G-I-L-L-I underscore Anne, A-N-N-E 1. So at Jilly Anne 1. I don't post a lot about research, but sometimes.
Twitter's fun all the same.
Twitter is fun all the same. People can people are welcome to come and chat with me. If people want to go read more about Epiphany, I recommend Georgia Petridou's book. Petridou is P-E-T-R-I-D-O-U, or Verity Platt, P-L-A-T-T. They work in classics. If you want detailed analysis of Epiphany and Joseph and Asenath, you can go read my article at the Journal for the Study of Judaism, which is called Asenath's Epiphanies. That one's behind a paywall, so if you want it, just send me a message on Twitter and I can also send the PDF. That's always an option too. And as far as reading fun Epiphanies, any and all of the Homeric hymns, I'm a huge fan of the Bacchae as well. One of the things we didn't get into, but I'll put in a little moment here. One of the fun things about Epiphany is the irony of who knows and who doesn't know.
Ooh, yeah.
Yeah, and so we get this. In the Bacchae, we get it as we know who Dionysus is and we know why the chains won't hold him. But nobody else does, right? And so there's a sort of the wink to the audience of, you know, who knows what. And the same goes with Anchises, right? So we know that Aphrodite is a goddess and we know that her costume is absolutely useless because, you know, the goddessness is showing through. And Anchises, he doesn't name Aphrodite, but he says, you know, are you a goddess? Are you immortal Athena or divine Artemis? And she goes, no, I'm just a virgin maid frolicking in the hills. It's like, yeah, okay, sure, Aphrodite, sure.
You're convincing everyone.
Yeah, you know, those boots ain't divine. Yeah, sure. Okay, girl. Everyone believes you. And, you know, something very much at play also in the Gospels, for example, right? Who knows Christ is divine is a part of the storytelling device of those different stories. And depending on whether you're reading Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John, the divinity of Christ varies, or the representation of Christ varies, and who knows that Christ is divine varies as well. And so there's a lot of fun to be had in rereading these stories with an eye to who knows, who's in on this, who is aware of the divinity of the character. And once you ask that question, rereading any of these texts is really interesting, because does Telemachus know that he's talking to Athena?
Yeah.
You do, but does Telemachus? And then she flies off and he goes, oh, that must have been a goddess. And you go, oh, right, he didn't know. Wow, that's so cool. And in some of these stories, you know, like in the Bacchae, for example, learning that it is a god who has appeared is the dun 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 kind of moment, because it's when Pentheus finally figures it out, it's too late, because now he's been ripped apart by the Maenads, right? Or the same, Dionysus is involved with some real gory epiphanies.
So
but when he's on the boat and the sailors realize, yes, or the pirates realize that he's a god, well, at this point it's too late, because now they're transforming into dolphins. And so the moment of knowledge comes at a terrible consequence, to, you know, circle back to Oedipus, who we were talking about before.
Yeah.
And so encountering the divine is an incredibly dangerous thing at any storytelling level, in any ancient culture. And so it's not always hunky-dory, happy-go-lucky, this will end well, I'll found a cult, it'll be great. There are stories where encountering the divine results in some serious damage or transformation that is not, or, you know, sexual attention, which is not welcome. And so it's a really powerful storytelling device, and the power comes from the danger as well as the beneficence that can happen. So it's all of which is to say that if you do ever think you've encountered the divine, be very, very careful, because it might leave you very scathed.
If my listeners have learned anything from this show, even without my use of the word epiphany, it's stay away from the gods.
If you can avoid encountering a god, absolutely recommend it. A god, a cyclops, a sorceress, a siren, like any and all other worldly creatures, just don't. Mm-hmm. Just don't.
Yeah, troublemakers.
Just troublemakers.
The Bacchae stuff is so interesting. It makes me think of Dionysus's like birth too, and that epiphany.
Yes,
and that one is so like, it's one of the very few encounters with gods that's so explicitly deadly, like just burst into flames and she's gone. In a way that like has always been interesting to me generally, but now even more so.
Well, as you say this, I've never thought of this before. I wonder if Dionysus's intimate association with Epiphany is not in some way related to his first birth story. He first comes into this world through violent Epiphany. Mm-hmm. And then he himself is associated later with numerous Epiphanies, many of which are violent. So I wonder if there's not some sort of connection there, but it wouldn't be possible to make in a true intertextual way, because one of the best tellings of Semele's epiphany is Ovid, which of course is much later than the Bacchae or the Homeric hymns or any of that. But there's definitely a thematic connection between Dionysus's mother's untimely and horrific demise and Dionysus's epiphanies. But now that I've mentioned all this, the next time you read Ovid and you read Semele, watch for the who knows what game.
Yes. It's funny thinking about that. I know the story of Semele through just like, you know, hearing it enough times and remembering. But then, when you say that, I'm like, oh, I couldn't actually tell you an ancient Greek source for that story, which of course is like always a thing I'm running into just generally.
Always, yeah.
But
because in Ovid, it's really quite tragic. When I read that story, it makes me quite sad, because Juno, of course, disguises herself as an old woman and dupes Semele into asking to see Zeus's divinity. And Semele thinks she knows. And so she does know. She knows that he's a god, but she doesn't actually know the consequences of knowing. And so she knows that one of them is a god, but she doesn't know that the other one is a god. And Semele plays off of her naivete, if not her ignorance. And so it's just, that's one of those moments where it's not funny to be the audience who knows, because as the audience member, you know, it's just going to end so badly. It's not like when Telemachus doesn't know that it's Athena, because that's, you know, she's the protector of heroes. It's not going to go badly. So it's just sort of amusing to know when they don't know. Or in the same with the story about Jesus, it's amusing as the audience to know, and it makes you an insider to the divine or an accomplice to the divine. But the Semele one is hard. It's a painful narrative.
Yeah. I mean, it really is the only like encounter with Zeus that does end quite so tragically. Like they're all obviously tragic for traumatic reasons, but not for deadly reasons like that of Semele. Yeah. I love to just talk through it, something enough to realize how it's unique and in what ways it just always had so much more.
Well, and it's one of those things I'm struck time and again how scholarship actually advances in the conversations. It doesn't advance in the reading and the writing. Those are the sort of end products of advancement, but very, very seldom do ideas really strike us, or maybe I'm just projecting my own experience onto the world, but I have found for me that I'm not struck with new ideas when I'm sitting alone somewhere just bashing my head into a text. It's in you know, having conversations with you or with other people, and I go oh yeah, I've never thought of that before, and it's because of the way you phrased something about Semele that I thought about it for the first time. I was like, oh
yeah,
cool.
Yeah, I know, it just adds so much. It's just, oh my gosh, yeah. That's why I love having these conversations so much. It's so exciting.
It is. It's so exciting.
Yeah. Well, I love that all of that came out of wrapping it up. So I'm thrilled we did it that way, because I could talk about Bacchae forever, like till the end of time. That play is my favorite thing.
So good.
But yeah. Oh my God. It is so good. Well, again, though, thank you so much for doing this. I thank really appreciate it. It's been really fun.
Yeah, this has been the highlight of my day and my week. So, you know,
oh, so it's glad. Great. So glad. Thank you. Oh, nerds, nerds, nerds. Thank you, as always, for listening. And again, as always, fuck, I love these conversations. So I'm writing this script after both editing this conversation with Jillian and then recording a 2-hour conversation on Spartan myths. And so, well, my obsession with how cool my job is and how much I love talking to these experts is very fresh. This one with Jillian was just so damned interesting. Like, it turns out I've been reading about epiphanies, like, nonstop all the time, but I've never known that's what I'm reading about, or, like, how to define them, or what makes them special. It really adds so much to these stories. It's such, like, a visceral idea. It makes it so much more real. This epiphany, a god appearing before you in so many different ways. It opens up so many questions. Like, most importantly, what does a god smell like? Does Demeter smell better or worse than Zeus? Do they have their own kind of divine musk? What is the deal with that? And perhaps most importantly, am I the only one who is now absolutely enthralled by the idea of a godly scent? Is that super weird? Only time will tell, I suppose. Again, big thank you to Jillian for coming on the show and bestowing this knowledge. It was so much fun, and I'm so thrilled for you all to have heard this episode. You can find a link to Jillian's Twitter in the episode's description. Thank you all. As always, you're the best. Hey, remember when I was reading 5-star reviews on the episodes? Why did I stop doing that? The answer is ADHD, but I would love more reviews from you all. Mostly 5-star reviews, to be precise. More 5-star ratings on Spotify, even. So, you know, do that for me, would you? And thanks, here's one of them that made me laugh. It is from Norway and is titled simply, A Man. I am a man and I am obsessed with this podcast. It has everything, bloodthirsty gods and humor, which makes you burst into laughter at the metro and other non-suitable places to laugh out loud. 10 out of 10. Listen if you want to learn more about Greek mythology and also want a good laugh. It's signed a Norwegian cow, who I now love. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is written and produced by me, Liv Albert. Michaela Smith is the Hermes to my Olympians and handles so many podcast-related things, including getting me this guest on the show, because she spoke at Michaela's school, and Michaela was like, this would be super interesting, and it should probably be on Liv's podcast, and then Jillian was interested, and then here we are. Stephanie Foley works to transcribe the podcast for YouTube captions and accessibility. She's awesome too. The podcast is hosted and monetized by Acast. You're all the best. It's so fun to share in this epic nerdery every moment of every day, including what do the gods smell like? I am Liv and I love this shit quite a lot.
Now I'd like to introduce you to Meaningful Beauty, the famed skincare brand created by iconic supermodel Cindy Crawford. It's her secret to absolutely gorgeous skin. Meaningful Beauty makes powerful and effective skincare simple, and it's loved by millions of women. It's formulated for all ages and all skin tones and types, and it's designed to work as a complete skincare system, leaving your skin feeling soft, smooth, and nourished. I recommend starting with Cindy's full regimen, which contains all five of her best-selling products, including the amazing Youth Activating Melon Serum. This next generation serum has the power of melon leaf stem cell technology. It's melon leaf stem cells encapsulated for freshness and released onto the skin to support a visible reduction in the appearance of wrinkles. With thousands of glowing five-star reviews, why not give it a try? Subscribe today and you can get the amazing Meaningful Beauty System for just $49.95. That includes our introductory five-piece system, free gifts, free shipping, and a 60-day money-back guarantee. All of that available at meaningfulbeauty.com.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Are you tired of your scented cleaning products smelling and cleaning like meh? Then it's time for an upgrade with the power of Clorox Scentiva. With an uplifting scent that smells like coconut, Clorox Scentiva gives you powerful clean like Clorox, but a feeling like being transported to a tropical island retreat. Imagine putting your phone on Do Not Disturb, tuning out all the constant, just the feeling of warm sand in between your toes and a fruity drink in your hand. The ones with the little umbrella. Refresh your home to feel like an all-inclusive vacation by getting Clorox Scentiva. Also available in grapefruit and lavender scents at a nearby retail store.